Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with the mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'm Tamara Strauss, trends editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. Today, filmmaking is undergoing a revolutionary transformation thanks to computer technology. 100 years ago, film was magical for its ability to capture and reorder reality, and celluloid cameras and simple editing machinery were the key storytelling tools. Now, filmmakers can simulate every conceivable image or idea to the point where sets and even actors can be visualized using zeros and ones. The relative affordability of digital cameras, editing tools, and distribution methods is also democratizing the movie business. This panel brings together leaders of the digital film industry to talk about the ways computer technology has affected and influenced filmmaking as an art, as an entertainment form, and as a business. I would like to introduce our panelists. To my direct left is Richard Chong, co-founder of Pacific Data Images, which was recognized by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences with the Technical Achievement Award in 1997 and acquired by DreamWorks in 2000. His handiwork can be seen in Ants, Shrek, Shrek 2, as well as Minority Report and Broken Arrow. Jeff Fino is co-founder and executive producer of WildBrain, a 12-year-old computer-generated animation company. Jeff manages a range of projects from LucasArts' Star Wars Episode I CD-ROM and Universal's The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle to commercials for clients including Coca-Cola, Nike, and Levi's. Next, we have Stu Mashwitz, director and visual effects supervisor and chief technologist of The Orphanage, a special effects and film production company that he co-founded with veterans of George Lucas's Industrial Light and Magic. Stu has created and supervised special effects for Sin City, Men in Black, and Mission Impossible. And last but not least, we have John Knoll, the visual effects supervisor at Industrial Light and Magic of Lucasfilm. He has received 3 Academy Award nominations for Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones, Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, and Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl. He is also known for co-creating Photoshop. Please welcome our panel. So I think it's important to note from the onset that these 4 people represent different sides of the digital film industry. John Knoll and Stu Mashwitz are shaping studios that largely focus on digital special effects. Richard Chong and Jeff Fino are devoting much of their work to making CG or computer-generated animated films. And whereas Stu and Jeff represent smaller, newer digital companies, The Orphanage and WildBrain, John and Richard represent more established older companies, ILM and PDI DreamWorks. I want to start with a futurist question. What do each of you think the filmmaking process for digital film will look like in 10 years? Richard, would you start us off?
It's a tough question for me. Actually, recently I just cleaned up my office. At home, my wife said, oh, you got too much junk, better clean it out. And we just had our 25th anniversary. So I looked back at my notes of where the future will be back 24 years ago. And surprisingly, it was pretty close. But then I thought about looking forward another, 10 years. It won't get any easier. I think it's just that we will have a lot more latitude what we can do. I don't think my job gotten any easier in 25 years. It's always been the same amount of work, no matter how hard I try to make it less. But I think what people will have at their fingertip is a much more broader form of creativity than we did 25 years ago. It's really, the creative process will never speed up, but you just can do more things.
Yeah, I'd say that there's been a great democratization of technology where the tools to do this work have become cheaper so that the bar to entry is much lower. So that you still need talent, but you don't have to scrape together as large a collection of cash to be able to start a production. You know, you can do pretty good work with a relatively inexpensive video camera and digital editing system.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the same way that people thought, you know, the advent of computers would decrease the need for paper, I think the same thing goes for the added technology. It doesn't make our lives easier. It makes it, you know, you could speak to that. You guys can speak to that. It makes it more challenging and raises the bar a little bit. For animation, though, I agree with Richard in that not much has really changed in the years, in the 100-plus years since Winsor McCay was making films in animation, in that you still need a great story, you need great acting of the characters, good design, and, you know, people to show up who like animation. I mean, I think animation is experiencing an unprecedented popularity, but the way we approach it is surprisingly similar to what was done, you know, 100 years ago.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add to that, because I agree with everything that's been said, is just that the interesting thing about film, and I think the reason why it holds some allure to us, is that I feel like it's a device for, and I'm not talking about celluloid film, I'm talking about when we go to the movies down the street at the Metreon, what are we experiencing? Well, I think we're experiencing angst and strife and collective pain and effort and ideas that people had, and that stuff isn't going to get any easier. You know, film is a great machine for capturing that stuff. It puts up on the screen the amount of effort that was put into the creation of the images themselves. The democratization of the tools is great, but everyone can buy a typewriter, not everyone can write the next great American novel, you know. And for filmmaking in particular, the most valuable asset and the most difficult thing to create is the thing you put in front of the camera, not the camera itself.
I've heard two criticisms about digital filmmaking. One is that because the technology lens for these amazing special effects, the films are dumber. You know, you have these blockbuster films with, you know, special effect after special effect, and it hits you on the head. And then the other criticism I've heard is that the democratizing effect, that suddenly we're seeing, you know, films from all over the world that we wouldn't have seen otherwise that have been made cheaply and have been made by small crews. I think of ABC Africa, I think of Kiarostami's films. So do you think both of those things are going on? Do you think both criticisms are true?
Okay, well, let me speak to the first point first. We don't make the films dumb. The directors and the writers make them dumb. So, you know, like, my company is we're a service organization, and we're providing a service to other filmmakers. So we don't write the scripts, and we don't direct them. We try to have some influence over them, and we try and pick and choose the better projects. But, you know, it's going to take the filmmakers realizing that the novelty is worn off and people aren't going to go see the pictures just because of some flashy images. It's just as hard for us to work on a bad film as it is on a good film, except at the end when the bad film comes out, it gets dismissed as just another bad special effects extravaganza. And that's discouraging for all of us. We would much rather be working on good movies than bad ones.
But I would also add to that I want to make an analogy, because I'm looking at a room full of people, and let's just say I was a chef that was going to prepare a meal for one of you. I could make something extraordinary and weird and awesome, you know, and maybe a little challenging. Maybe it has some kind of crazy seafood in it or whatever. And, you know, a couple people might love it, right? And a couple people might be allergic to it. Okay, so now I need to make it for three of you. So one of you is allergic to shellfish, so I have to remove that challenging ingredient, you know. And now I have to make it for 10 of you. Now, well, you don't like mushrooms and you don't like carrots, and so I have to change my idea again. I have to kind of take away everything that was interesting about it and make it meet the needs of 10 people. Now I have to make it for all of you. I couldn't possibly make anything that all of you would eat and enjoy. I could make make a piece of bread that all of you would maybe eat, you know, like a vegan cracker that maybe everyone in this room would eat. But so if my business model requires for success for every one of you to buy my cracker, it's going to taste like crap, you know? And but if I can make a cracker that is for a specific person or a specific crackerly needs, I can make something amazing. You know, unfortunately, John and I work on a lot of movies that that every one of you need to buy a ticket for in order for it to be successful.
What was your impression of the Oscars this year? There was a lot of hand-wringing. I remember Jake Gyllenhaal going on about how, you know, he could never see a great movie on a DVD, that it would be a great disservice to his viewing experience. Are people in Hollywood afraid of the future? Is this a sign?
Well, I don't know. Do they have to be? I mean, why are we all... You guys can all listen to this on the radio if you want. Why are you here, you know? You came here to have an experience with people you don't know. Sit next to someone and communally experience, you know, Jesus, these weird freaks up here on this. I mean, you know, I saw a movie the other night and I was annoyed by the audience I was with, you know. But at the same time, I would prefer that annoying experience than to get it on DVD. And, you know, I want to sit around the fire and hear a story told to me. And when I laugh, I want to hear other people laugh.
Jeff, when you're making an animated film, though, do you think, well, this is going to be seen on a small film potentially? Do we change the way we make this film?
Well, I think if you know you're making it for a TV screen rather than a movie, sure. But I'd like to hit on another point there, which is I think the movie studios are a little afraid of the future because they don't really know what the future is. They're at a very crucial crossroads right now, where you're having, theatrical releases, DVD releases, iTunes, whatever, downloads from computers. Steven Soderbergh released Bubble simultaneously on DVD, and the only theater that ran it was the film's producer. The theater exhibitors wouldn't do it. They're going to have to sort that out in the very near future, I think. But I think, you know, What their reaction to that is to form a studio coalition, and I don't know if you've ever spent much time in Hollywood, but they can't even agree amongst the one studio to get all the studios together. They can't agree on a standard for DVD. Mm. So there's a lot of work that needs to get done there. But I think you know, we're going to see some changes in that arena as far as, you know, animation is concerned. I mean, you know, we get a bit of a pass because I think there's a different audience. There's a kids audience. People are happy to watch them in the theaters. People are happy to watch animation on TVs, in the back of their cars now more and more, which is a little disturbing on the dashboards, you know. Yeah. So I think, you know, we get some slack there.
I'd also like to say that I think a lot of the discussion about go to the theater because it's a bigger experience. I think I think it's incumbent upon the filmmakers to make sure that the theatrical experience actually is better than the home experience. And as the home experience continues to get better, and the theatrical experience continues to degrade, both. By, you know, people just sort of lacking common courtesy about turning off their cell phones and talking, and then no real care being taken in the presentation at the theater with very dim projector bulbs and dirty screens and sticky floors and all those sorts of things. You know, honestly, I prefer watching things at home at times. It's just a much more pleasant experience. And if the filmmakers want people to be in seats at theaters, they have to make sure that that's really the compelling experience, that it's genuinely better and not just go because we want you to go.
I wonder, I think I'd like to talk a little bit about Pixar and its acquisition by Disney. This is a film company based here in the Bay Area that's had no film failures, and here comes Disney, huge Hollywood company, and acquires Steve Jobs' company. What does this indicate to you about the state of animation, about Pixar's mojo, about possible synergies between the Bay Area, where film technology is so strong, and Hollywood?
Well, I can speak to that, having lived that for 5 years now. We were bought out by DreamWorks in the early 2000s, and, you know, we've been part of that experience of how does a technology-oriented service company in the Bay Area work with a major Hollywood studio. And one thing I can tell you now is we wouldn't be here today on our own And I think it's probably true from the other direction as well. I think it's really the combination of, in some way, the talent from both sides that make us allow us to do the type of project we want to do. Because we're, as a studio, we get asked these questions all the time, you know, what do you think about all the market change and all that. But we're not really that big a studio. We only deliver 2 films a year, which is not a big studio by any means. But we really focus mainly on the creative. I mean, surprisingly, I think for a studio to be successful, it's less about the technology, less about, you know, how you do it, where it's delivered, but about the content. So our biggest effort, I think, within the studios, which is not, you know, clear to a lot of the audience, is focus on building creative.
Hmm. I'd also like to say that, you know, you see a lot of copying of success in Hollywood. Anybody does something sort of new and original or that is successful, it's immediately copied by anybody who can scrape the resources together to copy it. But what I saw happen after Pixar's success is that Hollywood's copying the wrong aspect of it. They're copying that it's computer-generated, not that the stories are good. And if you look at why the Pixar films are so successful, it's because there's good stories with good characters. And it really almost doesn't matter what the technique is. You know, Pixar does a really good job of making the pictures look good, but they start from a really good story. And you see, that's, in general, not what's being copied. They're not copying the really good stories.
That's so true. And there's 2 really interesting aspects to that. One is that Hollywood gets confused, and I group us with that too. Hollywood gets confused because they want the reason for a movie's success to not be that talented people told a good story. They want it to be something that they can predict, right? You know, mm-hmm. so that they can suss out how they're gonna, you know, yeah, rip it off. But the other thing is that every time Pixar has made a successful movie, they've then turned around and done exactly the opposite. You know, they have not made any effort to duplicate their own success. They come out with one of their most phenomenally successful movies ever, and then they immediately turn around and do something completely different. And I think that is their true genius, is that they will continue to challenge themselves. They are the ultimate audience over there. You know, if you ever have the pleasure of going and visiting Pixar, what you see is a bunch of people who are just excited to go see a great movie, and the only way they figured out how to make a movie that they really would like to go see is to, or how to see a movie that they really like is to make it themselves, you know?
Yeah, and what they've done is counter, as you said, is counter to everything that usually exists in the making of a film in Hollywood. And let me say, I mean, I think Pixar is the most successful entertainment film company of all time. It's an unprecedented success. And companies like they and PDI, DreamWorks, have opened up a new window for all of us who do this kind of work. So we owe them a real debt of gratitude. The other thing that they do, though, that is counterintuitive to the whole process in filmmaking is they get the time to do it. They get you know, it's no coincidence that their stories work because they work on them. They spend a lot of time in story. They spend a good 12 to 18 months or more just in story, sussing out what their story is going to be, getting it up on as we call reels, storyboards, and they may even reanimate up to 10 or 20 minutes of the film, and it takes a long time. Their films take a long time to make. You probably don't have that luxury. You guys don't have that luxury of schedule. You know, if they have made that happen, though, that doesn't take anything away from them. They have been able to hold off the studio hounds and do things the way they want to do them. And lo and behold, they're successful.
They are criticized, however, for engaging in what some people call collective filmmaking. And this is part of the criticism around digital film, is that the auteur culture is being lost. The, you know, maverick film director who goes out and has this single vision, and then through, you know, dictatorial director's type of vision is able to produce something absolutely memorable. Whereas what Pixar is creating are children's films, and they are magnificent in terms of story and visuals, but are they lasting cultural artifacts?
Oh yeah.
I disagree.
Absolutely.
I disagree with the premise that it's related to technology, because I don't think it is. It's related to the size of the productions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When there is so much money at stake, now the model has become these these $200 million movies that so much money is at stake now that it has to be in the top 20 all-time grossing pictures just to break even now, that there's so much hand-wringing and concern about, you know, Stu's very issue of, well, does this appeal to absolutely everyone? And if the pictures were smaller and lower budgeted, there'd be a lot less stress about making sure that you know, they can make $800 million worldwide on the picture. And I'd also say that the democratization of technology does make it easier for small independent productions to get off the ground.
Does it also make it...
I think isn't it a confusion, I think, about the filmmaking process that happens at Pixar? It's not a bunch of people running around on, like, Razor scooters, like, all contributing ideas to a movie, you know? But I, you know, I do a lot of live-action shooting. I direct a lot of commercials, and a common sort of workflow for me is to go and shoot a bunch of stuff and have kind of that more traditional filmmaking experience and then come back to San Francisco and do all the post-production and have a more Pixar or ILM-like experience of doing a bunch of animation that meshes with that photography. I like both parts of that, but I really wouldn't want to do either one exclusively. On the set, it's a collaborative experience. It's not me, you know, just screaming and yelling. I mean, I might scream and yell a little bit, but there's other people with good ideas, you know? And when you're going to make a computer animated film, you need to construct that same kind of collaborative environment. And that's what I think Pixar has just aced, you know, because no one's protected from it. Even the founders of the company, you know, when they felt like they were getting too successful, the founder of the company went out and hired the guy that he had the most verbal disagreements with when he was in film school to come and direct a movie there so that he would have someone who wouldn't have the Emperor's New Clothes syndrome, you know. They create a collaborative experience that they have while they're making the film. Those films have directors. Those films are authored. And, you know, Pixar has made more than one movie that goes on most people's top 10 list of great movies.
Of any movie, of live action. Yeah. I mean, there are no auteurs in animation. I mean, it's such a collaborative process. Not even John Lasseter. I mean, without, you know, people like Joe Ranf and Pete Docter and Andrew Stanton.
Well,
those films,
like,
wouldn't be what they are. I mean, he's a director and he deserves a lot of the credit, but there's a lot of people even beyond those.
But a Brad Bird movie is a Brad Bird movie, and yet obviously he can't make it himself. He couldn't make it himself if he was.
But Brad,
it
yeah,
but isn't that because the technology itself is collaborative? So there is this influence of the technology on the film. That in order to make these animated characters, you know, Richard Chong, maybe you could speak to this, so much time is spent figuring out how to do it using computer technology that you naturally get into this rhythm of collective work.
It's no different than traditional animation. Traditional animation, every artist will put their heart and soul into it. The success of an animated film is totally dependent on not the director, but the passion of the artists involved in the project. I mean, Pixar is successful, and we're successful because we inspire every animator to be at their best. That's sort of the nature of our industry, because it's not the performance of just a few actors, because a character of an animated film is performed by a whole room full of people. So in the live-action film, it's the director, a few actors that carries the film. For one of our films to be successful, everybody have to carry the load and exceed our expectation.
But so I think also I don't want to continue to try to deny the point that you're making, because there is also something that can happen. I think, John, maybe you'd agree with me on this. There's something that can happen in our industry, which is that things are, by the nature of how they're progressively creative, they can get a little over-scrutinized at times. And particularly performance issues, you know. And you're supervising a ton of shots right now that have a lot of, you know, character performances in them. And, an actor does some weird little quirky thing in a live-action environment. And that becomes like, you know, I just basically had a commercial that I shot a week ago completely saved by the fact that the actor couldn't hear what I was yelling at him over a loud fan. And when he was trying to hear me, he made this expression that my editor grabbed and used for a missing piece that I had forgotten to shoot and, like, saved my butt. And, you know, those kinds of happy accidents and those kinds of weird things, an animator that does something quirky and it reads as a mistake, it's really easy to build a system that prohibits those things from finding their way into a heavily technologically dependent film. Mm-hmm. And so you have to find a way to allow those happy accidents to breathe.
Yeah, and it's a two-way street because you know, directors can find technologists who can do these crazy things that they never envisioned. And like using the example of Brad Bird, you know, he's like, why can't we have fabric? Or, you know, like a technologist says, well, we can't do that. And he says, why not? And they go, well, I don't really know. And then they figure it out and they do it. So I think the creative will inspire and drive the technology and vice versa. I think it happens both ways in any successful production.
One thing I think people are not seeing in the type of technology film now that I think you will eventually get to is certain artistry in the work we do. I started my career as a painter, so I have one relationship to this that I still haven't figured out. I mean, as a painter, you can master your art over your lifetime. Same canvas, same brush, same medium every day. But unfortunately, we're in a field where the canvas and the tool we use are constantly changing. So we don't have the same be able to master our tool as well as a traditional artist, a traditional filmmaker. I think people may be seeing some of that. And I see it myself. I mean, I wish in my lifetime I can really master my art form. I think these guys all probably have similar goals as well. So.
Well, that's the thing. I like the explorative process. I like not knowing. You know, I like the messiness of it. So I don't know if I mastered it. You know, I mean, who's mastered filmmaking? Whether or not, even if the technology was static, you know, some people sometimes talk about like the perfect movie, like has someone made a perfect film or whatever, and an audience might think so, but a filmmaker would never think so, you know.
I agree. I one of the things I like about doing this work is that the problems are different every time. It's not the same thing over and over again. So I'm always doing something I haven't dealt with before, and there's something new and unknown about it. You know, you go into these projects, when you bid them, the bidding is just total guesswork because we haven't done it before. And you know, we've done enough projects like this that we have some idea of, well, I think it's going to take five guys, 3 weeks to do this, but it's guesswork, and you won't know until you actually go in and try it. And sometimes you're right, and sometimes you're wrong. And you know, it's great to be surrounded by a bunch of really talented, very smart people, and if you can't figure it out, somebody there is going to have a good answer.
Let's talk about Richard Rodriguez, the director of Spy Kids and El Mariachi, and more recently Sin City. I've heard a number of people in your field say, you know, he's someone to watch. Why is that so?
Robert Rodriguez.
I'm sorry, Robert, yeah.
Richard, you can watch him, too.
having worked with him a couple times, I guess I'll speak to that one. I'll tell you why. It's because he makes his movies for under $40 million. And so, therefore, he does not have the cracker problem that we talked about earlier. I mean, in your lifetime, did you ever think that you would see a black-and-white movie, incredibly violent black-and-white movie that starred Mickey Rourke and Bruce Willis and, you know, I mean, countless other enormous talent? It's like, you just can't do that, you know? But he figured out a way to do it that involved, you know, flying Bruce Willis out to Austin and buying him some ribs and having him there for a handful of days and shooting a third of a movie, you know, and yet what's interesting to me is more that, you know, he's been offered projects for $60 million, $90 million. He's been offered those huge movies. He always says no. He always says, I will do it for $40 million.
But what is it about the way he makes the films? He seems to have a lot of control over them because, you know, he's got the studio, I guess, attached to his property.
Well,
what is that studio like?
Yeah, he'll be the first to tell you that when, you know, you learn to do every job on the film set, you become very dangerous, you know. And that's what he does. You look at the credits and he, he's wearing a lot of hats, you know. Personally, I feel like that kind of robs, if I were to do that, I wouldn't have this kind of fun collaborative experience of working with people, but man, does it enable him to work fast. You know, he knows exactly what he wants and he knows exactly how to do it. Usually when John or I would be supervising visual effects on a movie, we would go out onto the set and actually actively supervise the creation of the shots that we were going to then augment in post-production. I don't even do that when I work with Robert because he knows exactly what he's doing. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a one-man band.
And
you know?
He edits his own films as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. and does the score.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you can argue that could rob from the quality of the film ultimately. I mean, I think Sin City was great, but I think some of his other films could have used another eye or two on him. I mean, you know, that's the downside of that. I mean, he has complete control, but he has complete control.
Say that about Kubrick.
Kubrick had other eyes looking at his films. I mean, he worked with the same DP all the time, and he trusted that person enormously.
There's last year at the opening of the Digital Letterman Center, George Lucas talked about the potential confluence between filmmaking and video game making, and he said that he was looking forward to a day when video games could have a narrative arc like a great film and characters that would move you and that you could interact with. Do you see that day coming? Is it part of this second century?
I'm not sure I agree entirely. I think that that films and video games are just inherently different media. One is an active medium, and one's a passive medium. And you know, I've heard a lot of talk over the years about how films, are moving towards a interactive mode, and I just can't disagree more with that. I think that if you're going out on a date on Friday night, you don't want to be involved in directing the outcome of the movie. You want to sit there and you want to watch the movie
If I walked up to you on the street and I just said, "Oh, dude, I got to tell you this awesome story. I just got to tell you about this thing that happened to me." Okay, so here's the setup. All right. And then, how do you want it to end? I mean, why am I wasting your time with that, you know? That's what you would say to me. You'd be like, "Dude, I thought you had a great story to tell me." And I'm like, "No, it's interactive."
But actually, I think George's point was that video games would get more movie-like storylines, and I think that at least the good video games have always had storylines as part of them. Hopefully that'll continue
like
to improve.
Like Pac-Man.
Yeah. Is,
no, it's got those little films in between, you know, you're like... No, I agree totally. I think video games can be a blast, but it's filling a completely different need, you know.
Do you learn from video games, though? Are there things that you take away when you've looked at them?
You know, one thing, I go to this SIGGRAPH, Computer Graphics Conference, every year, and I keep seeing demos of these, you know, very high-powered graphic cards that can calculate, you know, 3 billion shaded triangles per second, or what, you know, the numbers are always astounding. You know, everything that they're doing, and I look at a lot of what's happening, boy, why can't I render on one of these cards? And I don't need to need it to happen in real time. I'll go for 3 orders of magnitude slower than that, or 2 orders of magnitude. You know, right now our typical render times are, you know, anywhere from 2 hours a frame to, you know, 10, 12 hours a frame. You know, to get the kind of quality and complexity of imagery that we put in feature films. And, you know, they've remained constant since we started doing computer graphics back in the late 80s. And what's happened is there's sort of a pain threshold, sort of between 2 and 4 hours a frame, where you start to look at, oh, man, how can I cut corners to make this go faster? Either, you know, resolution or shading rate, or, you know, various knobs that you can trade off for quality versus complexity. And what's happened is, as machines have gotten faster and rendering algorithms have become more sophisticated, we're just throwing more complex scenes at them, so that the render times always sort of go up until you just can't stand it anymore, and then you start doing cheats again.
Yeah, I've been tracking that number for 25 years. Turns out it's 200 pixels per second. You'll think about this afterward. But what it comes down to be, that's the tolerance level of the animator, how much patience they have or how much time they're willing to sit there before the manager can yell at them for not finishing a shot.
Well, I had a shot at ILM that was 18 hours per frame to render, but it was only like 10 frames long. So I could still see it every morning, you know? That was, I think that's kind of... The constant is, if you can set it, it's sort of like slow motion bowling. You know, you roll the ball at night, and then in the morning you come into dailies, and everyone gets to see together whether or not you hit any of the pins. You know, it's a little, And if as long as you can see it something in the morning, then it's working. You know?
It's a very different medium than gaming.
So. Yeah, absolutely. The other thing is that I would just characterize gaming as being about that quantity of we can do this and we can do this more and we can add this level of detail and this level of realism and this like 400 frames per second frame rate or whatever, whereas film is always about less, you know. And you stand in a room and you see the room, you make a shot of someone in a room and you choose what to focus on. And then you choose shallow depth of field so that you don't see the person behind you distracting from the person that you're focused on. And then you shoot it at a frame rate that's the bare minimum acceptable for people to perceive smooth motion. And then you cut away from it when you're done with whatever the storytelling point of that was. Film is always about the absolute, you know, sort of efficient, minimal, you know, in the way that this sentence that I'm speaking is full of all kinds of words that any respectable writer would edit out of it because it's flowery language or whatever. It's just it's not important to the storytelling. And video games are completely the opposite. They're always about more. They're always about more and more immersive experience, more like reality. And film is anything but reality. And that's why we love it, you know?
Stu Mashwitz, Jeff Fino, you both started digital entertainment companies over the past 15 years or so. What would you advise people who are thinking of going down that road?
Don't?
Yeah.
No. I think it's exciting. There's a lot changing, even from, you know, we started 12 years ago and didn't have a single computer when we started. And now we can't seem to do anything without a computer being involved. I think it's a good time. I think, you know, the industry is, from live action to effects to animation, has opened up in some ways. In some ways, it's the same old studio system, but, you know, we were talking about game assets, you know, machinima, which is a new form of filmmaking where people are just, you know, stealing or using game assets to make their own films and add their own dialogue. Social computing sites, you know, iPods, I don't know. Who knows? That's the exciting thing about it. So I think there's, if you have a bit of a fear of the unknown, you know, shy away. But I think it's in a very exciting time to be doing the types of things we're doing. Because, you know, we've been saying it, you know, for the last 45 minutes or so, you know, it's about the content. It's about the storytelling. It doesn't really matter about the vessel that takes it, you know, to wherever it goes.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that, and maybe even just take it a step further and just say that, you know, I think there is maybe an undertone of a panel like this where we're talking about what technology that is, you know, that is central to this area is has to say about films, about filmmaking in Hollywood. And the thing is that I just went to film school. You know, I used computers while I was there, but I was at a film school, and I feel like the movies that I loved growing up are, I don't want to change anything about that experience for the people who are going to watch the stuff that I make.
And when you were in film school, were you aware that, you know, digital might have a less emotional quality than celluloid's 24 frames per second? Is that one of the things that spurred you to make Magic Bullet, the software program that helps to make video look like film?
Yeah, I was aware of that. That gets to a less is more thing. You know, film is actually fewer frames per second, you know, than video, and it's this weird sort of thing where video looks like a live event. It looks like a news broadcast. It looks, you know, like a soap opera. And film has this lyrical narrative quality. So I've, even, yeah, since film school, I've been systematically trying to find ways to basically annoy engineers and remove some of the pristine image quality of video, you know. So when you're, like, stuck with shooting on a video camera, you put all this, like, filters on the lens, and you do everything to try to, like, beat it down and add more to the veil that is in between you and the reality of what's in front of you.
We only have about 5 minutes left of the panel discussion, but I wanted to just move quickly to the subject of distribution. I read recently that Amazon is getting into new media film distribution, negotiating with three major movie studios to offer its customers digital downloads of films and TV programs. That's part of the future, but how much so? The idea that you'd see, you know, little bits of films or whole films on an iPod or a really small screen?
Well, I think that we're just on the very, very beginning part of this, that you know, right now bandwidth is still expensive and slow comparatively, so being able to download a real quality presentation is a little bit away because it's going to be, you know, many gigabytes worth of data to see a good presentation of a feature film. But the day is going to come when that's not a big deal, and you know, that could be an email attachment. So, I think it's a good thing. It as long as we can, you know, adapt to the new economic model. I think it is a bit of a problem when, you know, the technology is changing all around you and you're refusing to face that reality and sort of try and expect that the old economic model is going to hold forever. Like, you have to adapt to the new technology. People want to have a little more flexibility in how they look at things, and I think you got to step up to the plate and help them with that.
Does it spell doom for some big studios that you'll have these guerrilla filmmakers and they're going to be the ones that are ahead of the ball in terms of uploading their shorts and getting them out there, and they, you know, take over the market? Is that possible?
Well, I think in the same way that Hollywood copies anything successful, if somebody starts doing it and they're successful doing it, they're going to be wanting to be on the bandwagon there.
Hasn't really happened yet.
Yeah, I mean, just like when, you know, VHS tape came along, everybody thought everybody would be making video on their own, but it never happened. Because it really takes a real effort to make good content. I mean, people often sort of forget that point. I mean, you guys deal with it every day. You know how that's the most painful part, you know, coming up with good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, distribution is like a voodoo science, so nobody really gets that except the studios right now. And I'm not saying it's never going to happen, but I'm not convinced that that's going to change radically in the near future.
And for movie theaters themselves, are they going to make this transition to digital projection? That's so expensive.
It's inevitable.
Oh, yeah.
It has to.
Some's got to give. I mean, they're not. Most of the theater chains are doing poorly, and it's expensive to get it going. But they have to.
Mm-hmm. Film projectors are expensive too, you know, and they're not. They're not getting any less expensive.
And they've got it. They've got to improve the experience, or they're dead anyway.
For those of you who have questions, you should go to that mic, and we'll start questions in just a minute or so. And this is for radio. For the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's InForum program and how it will affect For the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's InForum program, and tonight we're talking about the digital film revolution and how it will affect film's second century. I'm Tamara Strauss, trans editor for the San Francisco Chronicle, and I'm here with Richard Chung of Pacific Data Images, Jeff Fino of Wild Brain, John Knoll of Industrial Light and Magic, Lucasfilm, and Stu Mashwitz of The Orphanage. Now let's go to the audience for questions.
Hi. This is a San Francisco-focused question. Lucasfilm has a studio, an animation studio in Singapore, and Wild Brain does some of its work in Asia, and visual effects from Giant Killer Robots is tripling in size and doing all of its growth in Canada. So my question is, should San Francisco try to keep as much job growth in your industry in the city as possible? And if so, what is the single most important thing the city could do to support your industry?
That's got to be for you, Jeff.
Oh, thanks. Well, I did see your piece in the San Francisco Business Times, and thanks for taking a shot at the DMACC. But I think it was a legitimate point. I mean, I think the writing's on the wall for some firms. I mean, in the case of Giant Killer Robots, I felt like they could take on more jobs simultaneously, which naturally means they're going to employ more people here in San Francisco, or at the very least make their jobs more secure. We've done the same for 12 years, where each job that we bring on, that even the jobs that we send overseas, we're hiring a core group of people who do the creative work here. You know, we've never had to apologize for that, because it's just the nature of especially doing business in the television realm and animation. What we have to do on the citywide in order to help with filmmaking. And I am the chairman of the Mayor's Digital Media Advisory Council, and Stu is also on the DMAC.
Right. But I don't have any opinions about this issue at all.
Thank you so much. it's got my back. I think, you know, there's a number of things we can do, and they start with the obvious, like tax credits, you know, citywide, statewide.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not glamorous. The answer to the question isn't like, you know, all kind of highfalutin like the rest of this conversation is. It's not that computers, like, run better in Canada because of the cold weather. Yeah, it's because they're kicking down dough to, you know, help bring work up there.
It's a national issue because, you know, in a country that – you know, allocates $16 million for the National Endowment for the Arts, whereas you have a country just to our north that's, you know, kicking out 40% for entertainment content for the companies that do that. We're at a decided disadvantage there. There are things we can do. There's educational programs that the DMAC's involved with to try to serve the underserved, to try to get more people with the skills that it takes to do these jobs, because a lot of it is about talent. And we have a lot of it here, and that's our advantage as well. We're not going to we're not going to get a lot of the jobs coming out of Hollywood because they're going to go right past us to Vancouver, but we're going to get to, you know, add incrementally to what we have already here. And for me, more importantly in some ways, to keep the people here that are here already.
Yeah, the thing I'll say is one of the things that we try and do all the time is to improve efficiency and work smarter. And if you work smarter, you know, your number one cost is labor, and if you can do the same work in less time, you know, it's cheaper.
Thanks.
Hi. I probably know I'm a video blogger. There's a film that, actually, I didn't see the film, but it's called Four-Eyed Monsters. And there's Aaron Kremley and Susan, I forget her last name. What I found unique about what they did is after they made the film, they made these short podcasts that were done every 6 weeks. They were very highly produced as far as spending those 6 weeks.
But then they stopped. Why did they stop? I'm a huge fan. I haven't seen the film.
I'm still waiting for the next one.
I know. I'm a huge fan of – I think they have one of the best video podcasts out there, except that their most recent one was all about how – it is totally painful and tearing their relationship apart that they're even making it in the first place, and they can't figure out how they can even, like, get the wherewithal to make the next one. I mean, you're a video blogger, and so you're actively involved in kind of trying to close this distribution loop, right? You're talking directly to your audience. You don't have
right.
to ask anyone's
That's
permission
my question
to
about that.
Post what you're going to post tonight, you know? On the other hand, you're the only person who can go out and generate traffic for what you're doing. If they succeed with what they're doing, then it's good for everyone. I wish them the best. I'm a huge fan of the Four-Eyed Monster podcast. And it's funny that none of us need to have seen the film in order to love the podcast.
Exactly. You know? And what's interesting to me is that it could make it possible to know an audience beforehand, rather than it being a crapshoot with a mass gunshot effect after a film is done, which is you build an audience right after or during a film, and you can actually project possibly the actual audience.
There's another example
in the theater
of that. It's maybe not quite as artsy, but there's a really well-intentioned filmmaker in Southern California who made a science fiction film called Radius, and he documented the entire thing and had a blog about it, and he developed a grassroots following of people who were so interested in his attempt to do accessible filmmaking that by the time the movie came out, he didn't need to find actual professional distribution for it. He could just sell it directly off his website, and he's doing really well with it.
Do you see that as a possibility for media, for network media marketing or publicity, that you can actually sort of reverse the way an audience comes to know of a film from the bottom, from the beginning of a film rather than at the end, and that the whole distribution system is sort of reversed in that way?
That system works up to a point, because at some point, if it works, then everybody does it, then it stopped working, because there's too much out there, which is one of the great dilemma we all face, because by democratizing everything, we have access to so much, yet because there's so much, we have very little focus, and which is a tough thing. I think the people in the industry have to figure out how to address that.
But I think in the same way that MP3s kind of foretold, you know, the eventuality of what would happen with people being able to download a whole movie and all the freakouts that would happen around that, I think we can look at audio podcasts as a really great kind of canary in the coal mine for people doing self-distribution of film as well.
Thank you.
Got to bring it down, sorry. Hi, I'm Amy Gershoni, and I have a creative agency here in San Francisco, and I had a question about talent and finding talent. San Francisco being this just wonderful place where people want to come live, so you get, you know, a great talent booth there. But I work with a lot of the design and arts schools here, and we do a lot of kind of trying to understand what kind of programs best equipped young people coming out of school directly for jobs just like what you guys are hiring for. And there is, it strikes me as an interesting mix, and I find this in my world too, is what, how much importance do you place on technology versus how much you place on creativity? I know there's specific engineering jobs and all that, but at some point it does cross. Where do you guys and your businesses really put the focus on, and what kind of education path do you think is ideal to work with you?
I think the hardest thing to learn is to be an artist and to have a good aesthetic sense. It's a lot easier to teach somebody who has a good eye and a good aesthetic sense to use a given piece of technology than it is to take somebody who's mastered a piece of technology and teach them to be an artist. So I think we're always looking for the artistic eye almost above everything else.
There's a lot of these schools like Expressions and all the stuff that are mm-hmm. churning out a lot of two-year programs that are just really technology-focused. You guys have an opinion about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I do, because I went to the California Institute of the Arts in Southern California, and I was there for, you know, 4 long years, and I had a great time. And I love to go and speak at schools like the Academy of Art and Expression Center for New Media. And I feel like those kids are missing out on an experience. I feel like they are too focused on the result. And they are at the time where they should be focused on the process. And the only way they can do what John says, which is to develop an eye, is that they should free themselves up to actually look around and find out what interests them and focus on that, you know? It's the weirdest thing, because I was accused by my mentors when I was in film school of treating it like a tech school, but I don't think I did that at all. I think I just kind of screwed around. And then at the end of it, I had all these films that I had sort of made because I wanted to, you know, and I showed them to people at ILM, and they gave me a job, you know, because I had wanted to make the kinds of films that had computer graphics in them. So it was through the process of being process-oriented rather than goal-oriented that I did my best work, you know, and that's something I remind myself of daily, and I really like to try to bring that message to the kids. Because you shouldn't be squandering all that time that you could be hanging out and screwing around, worried about what kind of job you're going to have. It sucks to have a job.
It's also important to include the fact that you don't really need a formal education to effectively do what we do. I mean, if someone comes in with their book and they're a brilliant artist, you could figure out how to train them up on the computer and do a lot of things. Maybe, you know, maybe not right away, but, you know, for us, and, you know, we're a bit more, you know, art-centric and things like that, but I'm always willing to train people up to do, to work on the computer, but as these guys have said, they've said it best, you know, it's like you know, the art and creativity is really up here.
Yeah, also, but I will say that the tools that we use are fairly complex and involve a long learning curve.
You guys pay people for 6 months to train up too.
Well, we train people, but we rarely hire people who have no experience at all yet. So you know, they have to have invested a little bit in learning the tools.
But we can tell the difference when we're hiring someone between the guy who learned Maya because he felt like he had to and the guy who learned Maya because he couldn't help but do it, you know. We can spot that.
Which might be a good lead-in for where I was going, because I had a question about to what proportion, I was looking for more of a quantified answer, but what proportion of the digital business is the take the red eye out, and can you make that day look like it's nighttime versus blowing up spaceships and special effects? I would imagine an awful lot of it's just the grunge of making mistakes in filming and otherwise prettier. And then as a follow-up to that, to what extent does that technology help democratize? I can't really say that very well.
Democratate?
Yeah, something like that.
We'll
how much
that
does
one.
That editing ability to just make this look better and to fix the problems, how much is that really going to democratize versus having to use the Internet to circumnavigate the marketing machines of studios? You understand?
That's like 17 really good questions that you just asked there.
Well, I'll give an analogy. I grew up in a printing business. When I went to school, to create a color separation meant you take a negative, you put it on a $250,000 machine with a drum that spins and a laser, and it took a very skilled person to do that.
Dude, we should make some software that would like help him out
yeah.
with that.
Hey, exactly.
I didn't think about that.
It's
yeah.
a good idea.
That was exactly my point.
Well,
Photoshop changed my world first, but it was years later before printers came out that it actually truly affected.
Well, there was a big established industry there that underwent a revolution there. And I think Photoshop is a good example of a democratization of technology. Part of the motive for developing that was looking at the capabilities of systems like Excitex and Crossfield had these very expensive but very cool digital retouching systems. But, you know, you rented time on them. It was $900 an hour to use it. And you could never afford to own one of those yourself. And I got exposed to the Pixar image computer at the ILM Computer Graphics Department. And it was the antithesis of interactivity, but there was a lot of power there. And I got a demonstration of how that worked. And I was a camera operator at the time, so I wasn't in the computer graphics department. But I went over and visited, and I got a demo of how that worked. And I was blown away. Implications of what that meant for the future weren't lost on me. And I thought, oh, this is just so cool. I want to have this. I want to have this tool that I can play with. But, you know, I could never afford to own one of those things. And I wanted to have what I was seeing there on the Pixar, but I wanted to have it on a computer that I could own myself and play with myself. And that was a lot of the motivation for creating Photoshop, was just to be able to have access to that kind of power.
A big theme tonight was good content, good story. What, in your opinion, is a good story, or what makes a good story a film?
Well, respecting the audience, respecting them as being smarter than I think a lot of people are being treated now.
Yeah, I'll just add to that there is nothing that we have found out since Aristotle wrote a book called The Poetics about what makes a good story. That's new. there's a lot of interesting things. Like, people go and see a movie and they come back and they say, I didn't like that movie, it was manipulative. But that's wrong. You actually, what you didn't like about the movie is that you were aware that you were being manipulated. We go to see the movies to be manipulated, we don't want it to be obvious, you know. The other thing is, like, I didn't like that movie, I knew it was going to happen at the end, you know. Well, if someone were to stop any movie, even a really great movie, in the middle, and ask you what was going to happen at the end, if you really thought about it, you'd probably know, you know? And Hitchcock always said that, like, what makes a scene suspenseful is not a surprise at the end of it, but is knowing the entire time that we're here at this panel that there's a ticking time bomb underneath this desk, you know? People get very easily confused about what makes a movie good, but the beautiful thing is you don't have to know. You know, there's a lot of people who will try to tell you what makes a story good. But as I'm sitting here talking to you, I can tell that you're interested in what I'm saying, you know, and I can tell if I'm losing you, you know. And that's why that process that we're talking about at Pixar is important. That's why they have to have some kind of collaborative filmmaking, because they have to tell each other the story and see if it's working. So if you're wondering if a story's good, tell it to someone. And if they fall asleep, it wasn't.
Following up on something you had talked about earlier, Stu, as an amateur filmmaker, I love the way film looks, but it's really hard to make digital look like film. I mean, John, maybe you can do it or your company can do it, but without spending a lot of money, it's difficult to do. We're talking about sort of the democratization of filmmaking. Could you guys talk about what may be coming down the pike technologically to make digital look more like film, and then kind of just as a futurist sort of looking forward, do you think if that happens, is Hollywood going to be shifting more and more to digital filming?
Okay, well, I had a bunch of discussions with actually George Lucas when we were starting Episode 2, which is our first foray into shooting all digitally, about what do we want the images to look like. And to some extent, we had to be faithful to the style book that had been established by the previous Star Wars pictures. But beyond that, I didn't feel like we had to make it look like film. I felt like we needed to have a good-looking image. And if it was a good-looking image, it didn't matter what it was actually originated on. And I don't... I liken this to any other revolution in technology in the filmmaking business. Like, when sound came out, it was different. A sound picture was different than a silent picture, partly because of standardized frame rates. And then when three-strip Technicolor came out, that was an extremely different look. And people got used to that look. And then when a color emulsion that's all single piece came out and you have more accurate reproduction of color, people got used to that as well. And there have been various changes in the stocks and all of that, and people get used to that as long as it looks good. And I think the same thing is going to happen with digital photography. As long as it looks good, people will accept it, even if it's not like what you saw 20 years ago.
But what's interesting is, like, what constitutes it looking good, you know? Because I'm kind of with you. I like the way film looks, and when I started making my first digital film, you know, I was, like, first in line to go buy the first DV camera, and I hated the way it looked because it looked like video. So I created this software called Magic Bullet that, you know, basically degrades the image until it looks like film, you know? and there's a big industry around that now, you know? So it kind of gets back to that less is more thing. I think that there is going to be a battle for your eyeballs in terms of, and there's a force of engineering that's trying to throw more resolution at you, more frame rate, a bigger television, all this stuff at you, and you know, just stay true to what you feel looks right, you know, because I think the Star Wars movies look great, but I think they would look terrible if they were at 60 frames per second. Mm-hmm. And there are engineers out there who disagree with me. So, you know, fight for it. Don't put up with it. If you see something that you don't like the way it looks, make sure you let folks know, you know.
Yeah.
Don't download it on iTunes.
Yeah, what you have access to now is already far exceeded what we had 10 years ago. I mean, we mm-hmm. made film 10 years ago digitally that looked pretty much like film. But I think people oftentimes don't recognize that technology, all these advances, is not a necessity of making a good film. I mean, even to digitally make it look like a good film. I mean, 10 years ago, we were 8 bits and mm-hmm. we were very limited color space, and we knew how to make it look like film.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I mean, there's a lot of really high, like, technical, nerdy things you can talk about what brings that nuance to film, but I'll tell you what brings the nuance to film is that you don't necessarily know what's going to happen. You know, you take a picture of a red apple, and you go and you project it in a theater, and it doesn't look so bright red anymore. And engineers everywhere are like, we got to solve that problem. And you're like, I love the way that apple looks. And yeah. Then you're like, got a guy with a silver ponytail who's like, well, I can figure out how to make that apple look better, you know. And screw that guy, you know. You grab the guy with the silver ponytail who's like, well, I could put something weird in front of the lens and smear it with my nose grease and make that apple look even weirder, you know? And you're like, that's the guy. That's the silver ponytail guy you want to be hanging out with.
Yeah, actually, that's one of the things that's been a trend in pictures the last bunch of years is digital intermediate for color timing. And that as soon as you are manipulating the final color timing on a computer, you don't have to stick to the photographic response of a particular film stock that you were working from. And I've started to see a lot of pictures that are experimenting with really different looks that are all being accomplished afterwards on a computer. And there's no reason.
Tatsi is one of them, right? The foreign film.
Pardon me?
Winner, the Oscar winner for foreign film, Tatsi, the South mm-hmm. African film.
Did you see? Oh, did that one have a DI?
Yeah, that had a lot of digital intermediate.
Yeah, it may have, yeah.
It's becoming more common than not now.
All right, we'll stop there. Let's give a big round of applause for our superb panel. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with the mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'm Tamara Strauss, trans editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. Today, filmmaking is under